Morning, everyone. Today's daf in the Durham is Pei Ches. Thank the Lubin Foundation for sponsorship of the daf. Daf is one of the Zechanish Maslipa, Gabriela Bashmuel. We start today at the Mishnah on the bottom of Pei Zayin and Beis, and Mishnah starts. Yodea ani Shiesh Nedarim. So the husband has got some sort of knowledge, but his knowledge is not that broad. And he says the following. He says, look, I know this is a thing called Nedarim. And I know my wife made a neder, and so far so good. Aval ain't a yodei shesh mafirim. But who knew about hafara? I never knew about it. Nobody told me about hafara. Now, of course, he could be listening to chumash during the weekend. It happens to be the first aliyah in Parshas Matos. So he's here, right. He's hearing it now on any given year. He's hearing it three times. Okay, but he's hearing, but he's okay. That doesn't mean anything. He doesn't know. So he didn't know. In other words, I'm familiar with the basic concept of neder, but what I didn't know is that you could do hafara. So, yeah, fair. So the Mishnah says that when he finally learns about this information of hafara, he could do hafara. Let's take a look at the Ran. The Ran provides some important context and detail to this halacha. The Ran writes, Yodei ani sheyesh nedarim, shemash nidra ishti havei neder gamur. He's totally familiar with the concept of neder. Aval ini yodei sheyesh mafirin shahaba mefresh shem neder lo shel inui nefesh velo shebeinu levana. And it, like we've discussed now since the beginning of this perek, two categories where a wife makes a neder and the husband can be made for the neder, and he didn't know this. So the Mishnah says, and there's no debate on this point. Yafir, look at the next run. It's important. La acher mikan kishenod delo haba shahaba yachol afir yafir toch oso yom sheyodeilo. So he could do hafara whenever he finds out about this concept of hafara. Meaning, let's say he hears his wife's neder a week, and he has no idea of hafara. And a week goes by, a month goes by. We could really stretch it out. And then only at a later point in time, he learns about this concept of hafara. Now and only now is he on the clock. Meaning, even though he knew about this neder for a long time, his lack of understanding, or knowledge, I should say, of hafara is as if he didn't hear. And therefore, only once he understands this concept of hafara, now he's on the clock. The Ran said it straight out. Because until this point in time, it's not considered Yom Shamo. Shmia doesn't just simply mean hearing the neder. Shmia means hearing the neder with the understanding that he has the ability and power to annul the neder. That is considered Shmia. And because in this particular scenario, he only knows about the neder, but he's not familiar with the concept of hafara, that's not considered Yom Shamo. And therefore, from the point that somebody spells out to him, did you know that when your wife makes a neder, that either applies to Inui Nefesh or Dvarim Shebeinu Levana, you have the ability to be Mayfair. From that point, once he's given that information, now the 24-hour clock starts. Good. Adkan, that takes us to the first part of the Mishnah. That's straightforward. Here we go. And this is where it's going to get a little tricky. Yodani sheyesh mafirin aval ein yodesh zeh neder. Look, in the second case of the Mishnah, he knows about the concept of hafara. Good. Here's what happened. Wife made a neder. He didn't know it was a neder. Now, what does that mean, he didn't know it was a neder? So the Ran over here explains his lack of knowledge that it wasn't a neder, v'ini yodesh zeh neder shezeh me'osa nedarim shaba mefer. So the Ran explains that what he didn't know is that this falls under the category of a neder that he can annul. In other words, he knew it was a neder, but he didn't know that he had the right to be mefer, and he knew about hafara. So over here, he's almost fully informed. Okay, I'm going to choose my words carefully. He's almost fully informed. He knows about the concept of hafara. He knows about the concept of nedarim. What the only thing he didn't know is that the kind of neder that his wife made is the kind of neder that he has the right and ability to be made for. He just didn't put together 2 + 2. Okay, so in such a circumstance, so avaini yodesh zeh neder. Rav Meir omer lo yafir v'chachamim omer yafir. So we have a machlokas in the Mishnah between Rav Meir and the Chacham. Rav Meir says he cannot do hafara, and the Chachamim say he can do hafara. Now, over here, the Ran goes over 2 explanations. What I'm going to do this morning is I'm only going to go through the first explanation of the Ran. Stay tuned. Don't stay tuned. The Ron does go through a second explanation, and perhaps the second explanation is even simpler than the first explanation. The reason why I'm only going to present the first explanation is because as we go through the Gemara, it's going to be a little bit easier to understand the Mishnah in the context of the first explanation. So therefore, what I'm going to do, just for the purposes of simplicity and brevity, is I'm just going to give the first explanation of the Ron. Let's see the Ron together inside. Igamanda Amar. So here we go now again. The scenario is, he knows about Hafara, he knows about Nedarim, he knows his wife made one, he just didn't know that that's the kind of Neder that he could be made for. So, Rav Meir says he cannot do Hafara. So the Ron explains. Again, this is the first explanation, it's the only one we're going through this morning. Ikaman Dama Delo Yafer Klal, comma. What Rav Meir means is that he can't be made for at all, period. Lo Hayom V'lo La'achar Sh'odiyo Shu Yachol Hafer, Shu Yachol Hafer. So, he can't be made for, period. Not today. Not when someone notifies him, hey, did you know that that was the kind of neder that you could be made for? Ramirez says unequivocally, the husband cannot be made for his wife's neder. Now, why? So the Ron goes on to explain. Hayom delo mikra yom shamo. Shehe mefer. Today's the problem with today is it doesn't satisfy the obligation of yom shamo. Meaning, we'll explain a little bit better in just a moment, but in other words, this is not the day they heard. Today the problem is very simple. The today is he just simply didn't know. Meaning he didn't put two and two together. He didn't know. He knew about Afar, he knew about Nadarm, he just didn't know that this is the kind of neder that he can be made for. Fine. So he can't be made for the neder today. So, and what about tomorrow? Because the problem is as follows. He knew enough. Meaning, although at the time when he heard, he didn't know that he can annul the neder, but he knew enough. He knew that A, it was a neder. He knew that B, he could be mefer in theory. He just didn't know that he could be mefer this. That started the clock. Clock started, and now it's more than 24 hours later, or a day later. It's over. It's too late. And the Chachamim disagree. And when the Chachamim say that the husband can be mefer, the Chachamim is describing that very day. Fine. In other words, the Chachamim are of the opinion that the husband cannot be mefer. The husband can be mefer, but only on the day in which he heard. Okay. Even though, by the way, it's going to be a little bit strange according to the Chachamim, where he didn't know enough, but in theory he could be mefer. Okay. So again, let's just quickly review. There are two cases in the Mishnah. The first case in the Mishnah is he knows about Nedarim, but he doesn't know about the concept of Afara. So the first case of the Mishnah says that's nothing. Meaning, that's not considered Yediyah at all. That's considered no knowledge whatsoever. And so if and when at a later point in time he discovers that he has the ability to be mefer, so then he can be mefer for his wife's neder, even if that's well after the time that she actually made the neder. The second case of the Mishnah is he knows about the concept of Nedarim. He knows about the concept of Afara. He just didn't know that this is the kind of neder that he has the right and the ability to annul. So here we have a machlokas in the Mishnah between Rav Meir and the Chachamim. Rav Meir says that he cannot be mefer, not today, and not at a later point in time. The Chachamim say no, that he can be mefer. Now,
so how did they deal with the sentence to Yom Shamor?
Let's take this step by step. According to Rav Meir, they says he can't be mefer. Well, today he knew. He knew that his wife made a neder. He knew can be mefer. He just didn't know that he can annul it. So according to Rabbi Meir, so that is it's not enough information. Meaning he can't be mefer today. Although according to Rabbi Meir, it's a little bit strange because then when informed at a later point in time, hey, did you know that you could be mefer that? Well, it's too late. Meaning, according to Rav Meir, the position is a little bit difficult to understand. In the Gemara, we're going to try to explain that a little bit better, but according to Rav Meir, it is a little bit difficult. And the Chachamim say no, that at least today, for the rest of today, he could be mefer. Now, Viriminu. Now, the Gemara says, now we're going to pose a bit of a challenge to our Mishnah based on a totally different topic, totally different context than halacha, and that is being sent into galus. We know that in American law, I guess, I'm not really speaking legally over here, but the idea of manslaughter is that you were responsible for the death of somebody, although you had no intent of killing him, but you acted in a way which resulted in the death of somebody. Okay, again, I'm not the lawyer, I'm not speaking in real legal terms, but the idea of inadvertent death. So the Torah says that if a person is involved in that, so he's got to be sent into galus. He's got to spend some time in the Ir Miklat until the Kohen Gadol dies, and then and only then does he get out. And the Gemara in the second parak of Makos, which later on in Shas, is going to go through the details of when exactly a person sent into galus. And the discussion over here is a very interesting discussion. Let's say that a blind person was involved in the accidental death of somebody. Okay, is he sent into galus? So that is a machlokus between Tanaim. It's a machlokus between Rav Meir and Rav Yehuda. Now, mind you, by the way, we just saw a machlokus in our Mishnah between Rav Meir and Rav Yehuda. And what we're going to do is we're going to compare these two cases. Now, these are strange cases to compare. We're talking about a husband who is not fully aware or cognizant of Nedarim. And on the other hand, we're now going to be discussing a person who killed somebody but wasn't fully aware that he killed somebody simply because he was blind. Obviously, these cases are not the same, but we're going to try, the Gemara is going to try to make a comparison between these two cases. So first, let's get all the information readily available, and then we're going to make the comparison. Rabbi Yehuda excludes a blind person from being sent into galus, meaning, if a blind person, by accident, kills another human being, and in general, it fits the general qualifications of what normally would a person be sent into exile for, right? The Gemara in Makos goes through many permutations of, right, the axe was on its way up versus the axe was on its way down. He was climbing up the ladder versus he was climbing down the ladder. Again, now's not the time to go through it, but just there are specific requirements necessary to be sent into exile, even though it was an accident. Let's say this blind person basically satisfied all those requirements. The only problem is that he was blind, which means that already he was dealing with a handicap of not being able to see the person in front of him. So, Rav Yehuda is of the opinion he's not going to be sent into galus, even though he was involved in the accidental death of another human being. And Rav Meir Omer LeRabbis is a summa, and Rav Meir has a very interesting opinion, which is no, that the summa is going to be included in the Parsha of Galus, meaning that he's going to be held as liable and as accountable as somebody who could see. Very interesting machlokus. What is this machlokus predicated on? So let's take a look now together at the Ran, where the Ran is now going to spell it out, and then the Ran is going to compare, because it seems to be a funny comparison, the discussion of being sent into exile and our discussion of Nedarim. Let's take a look at the Ran. The Ran starts on the bottom of Peizan Amad Beis. Rav Meir Omer LeRabbis Asuma Dekema De Islay Mixas Yediyam. Okay. So the Ran says like this. Look, let's first attack Rav Meir's position. Not attack it, but analyze it. Rav Meir says that we're going to include a blind person. Okay? Because a blind person, although he can't see, and certainly has a disability in terms of just not seeing the person there, but he has some awareness that the person's there. Okay? So he has what's called mixas yediyah. And what comes out according to Rav Meir is that in halacha, we're generalizing, but that's exactly what the Gemara is trying to do right now. In halacha, a partial knowledge is considered enough. Partial knowledge is considered yediyah. And now we're going to go with the first pshat that I offered in the Mishnah. Now again, I only went over the first pshat. So, and it goes like this. What comes out from the topic of galus is that partial knowledge is considered knowledge. It would obligate him to go into exile. And meanwhile, Masisan Tani, the Enu Yachalafir Bidiazu, Bobayom. And meanwhile, in our Mishnah, what did the Ran say was the Pshan our Mishnah? Where the person knows about Nadarm, he knows about Hafara, he didn't know that this is the kind of Neder that he could be Mefer. So he has a partial knowledge. And what did Rav Meir say? He can't be Mefer the Neder. Meaning, even if he tried to. Which I know is strange. But even if he couldn't be made for the neder. Why? Ama mixas yidia lavka chol yidia. Because that's not considered yidia. Even though he knew a little bit, but knowing a little bit is insufficient. You have to have all the knowledge in front of you. And so what the Gemara is doing is, in a generalization, is making this an issue of whether or not partial knowledge is considered enough. So just like the blind person in the case of Galus, partial knowledge according to Rav Meir is enough, so too over here, partial knowledge of the husband regarding an Adarim and Afara is considered enough. Mixas Yidia is considered Chol HaYidia. The problem, of course, is that Rav Meir now is flip-flopping. In the case of Galus, the blind person is required to go into Galus. In the case of Nadarim, the husband can't be made for the Neder. That's a stira. That's why the Gemara thinks that this is problematic. And now let's go over Rav Yehuda's position and the stira between Rav Yehuda and Rav Yehuda. And just right, an important note is that we don't see Rav Yehuda in our Mishnah. The Ran is about to point out that that's the Chachamim. The Chachamim in our Mishnah is Rav Yehuda, because who generally argues with Rav Meir? It's Rav Yehuda. So Prat L'Suma, Ama Mixas Yidia Lav K'chol Yidia. So in the world of exile, the blind person is not going to be sent into exile because he only has a partial knowledge. And partial knowledge is insufficient, and therefore he's not going to be sent into exile. Uvin Masnis and Amir Rabbanan, Dehain Rav Yehuda Duhu Bar Plukte, De Rav Meir, Yafir, Baba Yom, Bosi Yidia. And Rav Yehuda says that you can do Hafara, meaning on the day that you heard, even though you didn't know that you could be Mayfair, but you had enough knowledge, and that enough knowledge is considered sufficient. So by exile, it's insufficient, and by Nadarim, it's considered sufficient. Good. So that's the Ran's explanation of why the Gemara thinks that the Gemara thinks it's a stira. It's the Ran's explanation of the Gemara. Why is it a stira? Because Rav Yehuda and Rav Meir seem to be flip-flopping on the issue of how do we view a partial knowledge. Okay.
You're talking about partial knowledge for both Neder and Hafara.
Yes. In the case...
Because the first case is also partial.
Okay, good. I didn't read this part of the Ran. I'll tell you it outside. The Ran is going to end up saying that in the first case of the Mishnah, that's going to be considered zero knowledge. Very good. Danny, very good. Meaning that the Ran says that. Then the first case of the Mishnah, when the person didn't know it, when the husband didn't know about the concept of Hafar at all, that's considered not partial knowledge. It's considered zero knowledge. So very good.
In case of Rabbi Meir saying that this is a partial knowledge, the second case, the partial knowledge.
Yeah.
So if it's partial knowledge, then you cannot differ it. But once he gets complete knowledge, he should be able to differ it.
Yeah, I understand. That's the tricky part of this. That's the tricky part of this explanation.
Right.
Is that it's not enough knowledge where he can do the Hafar, but on the other hand, however, the clock starts running. I know. It's a difficulty in this first explanation. The Ran ends up giving a second explanation, but again, just
case, it should be able to operate. If it's complete knowledge, it should
right.
be able to
agreed. Right. The question works.
It should operate when it comes to complete.
I know. But the question just the steerer between our discussion and the one in Makos just works out a little bit better according to the first shot. But you're right. Okay. So the Gemara goes on to explain. No, that really don't compare these two issues because they are not necessarily connected issues. Because look, you have to look at the context of the Pesukim. When the Torah describes a person being sent into exile, which by the way is this week's Parsha, it happens to be exile is one of those topics that comes up again and again in the Torah. The Torah spends a lot of time talking about this parsha. Anyway, so Yavos Rebiyar. So when the Torah describes a person being sent into exile, it says that the man goes into the forest. Kol davar me'al liya'ar. So the Torah already is including somebody who's going to walk into a forest. Anyone can walk into a forest. A blind person can walk into a forest. V'suma nami bar me'al liya'aru. So already the Torah is already contextualizing and telling us that as long as you have the ability to walk into a forest, a blind person can do that. So now you can, you're already included in in this parsha of galus. The iamart below raos la rabbis asuma miar nafkale, and then the Torah didn't have to say the words below raos because the Torah could have just left it like that. What is the Torah driving at when it says lo raos elosh maimenak kalo raos prat lasuma? What the Torah is driving at is that lo raos means that you have to have the ability to see. Fine. And it's excluding the blind person. So in other words, just from the context, the Torah is talking about somebody walking to the forest, which could be anybody, even a blind person. Then the Torah goes out of its way to say, lo ra'os, it must be we're excluding a blind person. So in other words, let's segregate the topics of neder and galus. Galus is a different issue predicated on how to understand the psukim. And Rav Meir Sofer Ksiv Bivli Das, Kol Davar Meida V'Suma La Bar Meidahu. And Rav Meir is also going to contextualize the psukim. Look, the Torah says Bivli Das. He didn't have awareness. The Suma does not, already starts off from the position of not having full awareness. He can't see. He knows a little bit, but it's not considered yidiyah. It's not considered a full understanding of what's going on. Now, if the Torah is interested in excluding the Suma, the Torah would have done that without the words below Raos, because the Torah says velomeda. In other words, he need to have an awareness that already excluded the Suma. What is the Torah doing with the words below Raos? It's coming to include the blind person. Ron points out this is a concept that we've seen a number of times. This is mir acher mir, an exclusion after an exclusion. Right. Meaning once the Torah already excluded the blind person, why do we Torah have to say below Raos? It's there to include the blind person. So it's coming to include the blind person. So basically what the Gemara is saying is, let's not compare these two issues. The issue of galus is not a general discussion of how do we view partial knowledge as partial knowledge considered like full knowledge. That's not the case. The case by galus is how to understand the psukim. Where does the Torah start? And where does the Torah coming to teach us with the words lo raos? That's the machlokes between Rav Yehuda and Rav Meir, and therefore it is not comparable to our discussion. So let's not pit the machlokes of Rav Meir and Rav Yehuda as it relates to galus to the machlokes of Rav Meir and Rav Yehuda as it relates to nadar. Ad kan, that is the end of the discussion over here. Let's continue. Yeah, hamadir hana'a mechasno. Okay, a man unfortunately is fed up with his son-in-law, and he makes a neder, and he says that my son-in-law is not going to get any benefit from me whatsoever. The small problem is that his son-in-law is married to his daughter. Okay, probably not the healthiest of relationships, but again, we're learning in the Darim, and that's the lay of the land in terms of the Masechta. So who wrote to Lasis Labita Mo? So the issue over here is that he wants to give his daughter some money. Okay, how is he going to do that? How can he give his daughter money? Because by virtue of his giving his daughter money, it's essentially giving his son-in-law money, and he made a neder that his son's not going to benefit from him.
Is it masi yada if he gives her money?
Well, just one second. I'll explore some of the issues over here. So just give me a second. So I'm Allah Hare Amos Ha'elu Nesun Alach B'matana. So now he can do it, but he's got to present the money to her with the following formula, and he must say, this money I'm giving to you as a gift. But that's not enough. Your husband cannot have any permission to access this money. And even that's not enough. What you're going to do is you're going to take this money, you're going to buy food, and you're going to put the food in your mouth. And then and only then is it going to be considered yours. The Mishnah says that is the only way the father can give his daughter money and not be in violation of the neder that he articulated.
Okay.
So there is, but at that point the kinyan is exclusively hers and not his. So a couple things to go over. I'm going to paraphrase around over here. Everything I'm saying, again, I'm paraphrasing, so please read it yourself. But everything I'm about to say is really taken from the Ran. And so a couple things to consider. First of all, the Ran says that the Mishnah is very specific. The father is giving money to his daughter. Because had he been given actual food to his daughter and it hadn't been money, then we would never have a discussion. What's the problem? The problem is that in general in halacha, whatever a wife acquires goes to her husband. Okay, mashakana isha makanabala. That's the shita of Reb Meir, and that's, well, we'll talk about the halacha a little bit later on this morning, but that's the not generally accepted halacha, but that let's keep it simple. That shita is Reb Meir. Reb Meir says that whatever the wife acquires, the husband's going to acquire. the father-in-law made a neder that his son-in-law, his good-for-nothing son-in-law, is not going to get any benefit from him. So the problem is that any time that he gives something to his daughter, it's going to go to the husband and he's going to be in violation of the neder. Right? That's obviously what the Mishnah is trying to avoid. But the Ran says that he's trying to give money to his daughter. Food wouldn't be an issue. Why not? The Ran goes on to explain. Because when it comes to food, food can be given to a woman and not have to be stipulated, hey, this is yours and not somebody else's. The Ran says...
It's an indirect hana to the husband if he's not done well, for her meals.
Right. Well, that part is also true. But the Ran says, look, here's what we learned some time ago, back in Ksuvos. Actually, it also came up earlier in the Dharma as well. We know that the husband has to support his wife. Okay, that's one of the basic requirements of a husband to his wife is he's got to support her, he's got to feed her. And there's a ration of how much food he needs to give her per week. We learned that back in Masechta Ksuvos. Let's say he gives her that ration. Okay? And let's say this week she's dieting and she's successful and she does a good job dieting. And there's food left over. Who does that leftover food go to? Does that go back to the husband? So we learned earlier in the Masechta, the answer is no. It doesn't. Meaning, when it comes to actual food itself, once the food is allocated to her, it's hers, to the exclusion of the husband. And the Ran is assuming that would be true if the husband gave her the food, and that would be true even if somebody else gave her the food as well. Good. So the Ran says that's why the Mishnah over here is very specific in terms of the example given, and that we're talking about money and not talking about food. Fine. Now, when it comes to money, so that's basically what the Mishnah now is trying to accomplish. How can the father give his daughter money and not have the husband be automatically the acquirer of that money? So the Ran goes on to explain, this is what's happening. If he handed her the money and said, here, the money is yours, and even if he said, to the exclusion of the husband, the father could say anything he wants. If part of the legislation of marriage is such where any money that the wife receives automatically goes to the husband, so you can make all the stipulations you want, it's going to go to the husband. So that's why, says Iran, here's what the father's doing. He's saying, look, I'm giving you the money, but I'm not giving you the money. Right now you're holding the money. It's still my money. And then the next step is you're going to buy food with that money, but it's still going to be mine. The moment you put it in your mouth, then and only then is it going to be yours. At that point in time, it's going to be yours. Now we could say it's yours to the exclusion of your husband. Only after the food is in your mouth, now it's yours and it's not your husband's. So that is how he can give money to his daughter and then not be and at the same time not violating his neder. That is the Ran's explanation of our Mishnah. Now, Amar Rav, we start with the Gemara. Amar Rav Lo Shanu Ela Damar La Masha Atno Seis from the Sons Beficha Va Amar Masha Tirtsi Asi Kana Yasam Baal. Now, what Rav does in our Gemara is basically he seems to just simply be repeating the Mishnah, but as the Ran points out, but he's also arriving at the following halachic conclusion. If he doesn't say the formula as explicitly and as articulate as explained in the Mishnah, so then he's ran right into the problem of violating his neder. If he just simply said, if the father said to his daughter, here's the money, it's yours, go ahead, you do with it what you want, that's not enough. He violated his neder. Because then the money goes to her husband, because Rav holds like Reb Meir, that whatever the wife acquires immediately goes to the husband. So, Ushmul Amar, and Shmuel disagrees. Afil Amar Mashi Tirtzi Asi, Lo Kana Yason Baal. Shmuel says no. Shmuel says that if the husband gives money to his daughter, if the father gives money to his daughter and says, this is yours and you do with it what you want, so then, according to Shmuel, that would be enough to prevent the husband from owning that money. Now, as the Ran points out, Shmuel's not arguing with Rav in terms of how to understand the Mishnah. The Mishnah is pretty clear. What Shmuel's doing is he's arguing with the halachic conclusion. Meaning, what Shmuel's saying to Rav is, don't think that the only way to prevent money from going to the husband is only in this, you're holding the money, it's not the money's not yours, you're going to buy food, you're going to put food in the mouth, and then and only then is it yours. Shmuel says to Rav, you're right, that's what the Mishnah is saying. That's clear. There's no other way to explain the Mishnah. But what I'm disagreeing with you is, that's not the halacha. The halacha does not follow like Reb Meir, but rather the halacha is that a wife can be given money, doesn't have to be food,
and a stipulation is made that the food, that the money is not going, the food, I'm sorry, the money is yours then to the exclusion of the husband, and that's enough to prevent the money from going to the husband. Fine. Maskefla Rabbi Zera, Kiman Azla Hashmaita Derav Kerabi Meir. Dama Yad Isha Kiad Bala. So now, Rabbi Zera says, look, what have we just seen? That basically what Rav is doing is he's saying the halacha is like Rabbi Meir, that whatever the wife acquires is going to go to the husband or a minu. The problem, of course, is, not of course, let me not say this like this is so obvious, but the problem is a Mishnah in Erevin. Okay? Crash course in Erevin, or we've gone through the Masechta a couple of years ago in the Daf, but a crash course in Erevin, we know that if we have a group of people living in a chatzer, in one courtyard, a number of houses open up into one courtyard, so even though the house is a Rishus Yachid, the courtyard is a Rishus Yachid, we can't carry on Shabbos from one private domain to another private domain if that second private domain is either owned by somebody else or owned by the collective. What do? We unify. How do we unify? Everyone puts some bread in the basket. The basket is placed in somebody's house, and that now creates unification of everyone in the chatzer. Okay, it's a real crash course. Then the same thing can be done if, let's say, you have multiple chatzeres opening up into one mavui. The way that their cities were laid out back in the good old days is that you had chatzer surrounding a mavui. It's kind of like an alleyway. It's like a closed end alleyway, and that alleyway itself then opens up into the street. But if I want, but the alleyway is a reshus yachid, it's a private domain. If I want to be able to carry from my chatzer to the mavui, so we have to use basically the same operation, and that is by unification. Every member of each chatzer is going to contribute a little bit of, here it doesn't have to be bread, it could be wine, contribute a little bit of wine. That wine is going to be placed in one of the chatzers, and that creates unification, so that now everybody can carry from the chatzer into the mavli. Good. That for our purpose right now, that's enough information to get us through the Mishnah in Erevin. But just one more thing, and that is the following: we know we have the principle Zachan Adam Shlo Befanav. Right here in our community, we have an Erev, and every one of us has contributed bread to the Erev. Now, you may not remember it, okay, and it could be based on the fact that we just simply don't remember things. Or, more probably, and not more probably, but the reason why is because somebody did it on our behalf. Meaning, at the beginning of every year, so what the Rav does is he takes a box of matzah, he hands it to somebody else, and he says, you're going to receive this on behalf of you and everybody else within the community. Every other Jew that is within the environs of the Erev. Good. And that's what happens then, and that's Zachan La'adam Shlo B'fanav. And so, that procedure, that specific part of the procedure, all you need is the following. You need somebody to give the matzah, and you need somebody to receive the matzah. But here's what cannot happen. The person holding the matzah can't take it from his right hand and put it in his left hand and say, I'm receiving this on behalf of everyone else in the community. You need a giver, and you need a receiver. And it cannot be the person himself. And so, what we're going to learn together in Erevin is, in this Mishnah, is that not only can you not do it from your right hand to your left hand, you can't do it from you to your wife. Because that basically will be tantamount, right, that will be tantamount to moving it from your right hand over into your left hand. So let's see the Mishnah in Erevin, and then, of course, the problem is going to be, is that that seems to go, we'll explain the problem in just a moment. How do I do Shituv Mavui? By Chatzeres it's called Eruve Chatzeres, and by Mavui it's called Shituv Mavui. And at a different point in time we can try to go over why two different terms for basically the same idea. But anyway, so you put down the barrel and you say, this is for every member of the Mavui. Now what you're going to do is you're going to hand it over to somebody. Somebody who has a yad, somebody who has an independent hand. So you have an Eved Ivri, a Shivcha Ivris. Perfect. Good. They are an they're not an extension of your hand. They're Jews. They are indentured workers, but they're independent. They're not you. And you can hand it over to your older children. Older in this case means financially independent. And Al Yidei Ishto. I'm sorry, I set this up, but I missed one important point, and that is, in this Mishnah, your wife is also considered an independent entity, not a dependent entity, not an extension of you. Now, the Gemara poses a problem, meaning Rameir says, whatever the wife acquires is acquired by the husband, period.
And meanwhile, in the world of Erevin, the Mishnah in Erevin identifies a wife as an eligible candidate to be the recipient of the sheet of Mavui on behalf of everybody else. According to Rav Meir, isn't she basically your left hand? According to Rav Meir, would it be no different than taking the barrel of wine and moving it from your right hand to your left hand? Now, as the Ron points out, by the way, the question is not really going on Rav and Rav's explanation. The question is very basic. How do you understand the Mishnah in Erevin in light of the Shita of Rav Meir? Amarava afagav damar Rav Meir yad isha ki yad baal amod Rav Meir le'in shituf dekevim de la zachus acherim hu miyad baala zachya. So the Gemara is going to offer two suggestions. Suggestion number one of the Gemara, answer number one of the Gemara is Rava's answer, and it goes like this. If an outsider hands something to the wife, that immediately funnels over to the husband. Rav Meir would say like this. Part of the institution of marriage and the legislation, the rabbinic legislation that's built into marriage, is Masha Kana Isha Kana Bala. When outside money is coming into this structure, into this institution, and it's handed to the woman, so it immediately goes to the husband. Okay, and that will save a lot of fighting within the family. Fine. However, if the husband himself is giving something to his wife with the clear intent that you're going to accept this on behalf of somebody else, so then, even what Rav Meir would tell you that she has a legally recognized yad, so that she could receive it on behalf of somebody else. This is Rava's explanation of, you can hold like Rav Meir and still understand the Mishnah in Erevin. Good. Eisvei Ravina L'Rav Ashi. So the problem now becomes the following. Elu shezachin lahen al yedei b'no u'bito ha-gadon v'avdo v'shichas v'yivrim ve'elu she'ein zachin lahen al yedei b'no u'bito ha-katanim v'avdo v'shichas v'hakananim v'ishto. The problem is that we have another brisa. Now this second brisa that we're quoting is in diametric opposition to the first brisa that we quoted. The first brisa says that you can use your wife as a means of accepting the shituf on behalf of everybody. Meanwhile, this brisa says that you can't use your wife. So, Ella Amar Rav Ashi Masisim B'Sheish LaChatzer Ba'Osam Mavu Yaskinan Demiyu DeZachel Nafshei Zachel LaAchrina. So the Gemara now is going to provide a second solution to the problem. Really, the truth of the matter is that your wife's hand is considered like your hand. And any time money goes into your wife's hand, and it doesn't really matter whether it's coming from an outside source or it's coming from internally within the marriage, anything she gets is immediately going to be owned by the husband. That is the Shita of Rav Meir. And so there's only one, and that's generally true, and that's certainly how to understand the second brisa, because the second brisa says that the husband can give the barrel of wine over to his wife, and it's not going to work because it's no different than handing it from your right hand over to your left hand. What about the first brisa on this page? The first brisa that says that if you hand over the wine to your wife, that she can be a means of accepting on behalf of everybody else. So Rav Ashi says the first case is talking about a very specific scenario. And that is where the wife herself is a chatzar owner in this particular mavui. Begs the question, how could she be a chatzar owner if we're saying that everyone's going like Rabbi Meir? So the Ron goes on to explain that what happened is that she owned property before the marriage, and like we learned back in Ksuvos, what the husband then does before they get married is he waives his rights to that property before he gets married. After the marriage has started, and any property that comes subsequent to the beginning of the marriage is going to be his. And there's nothing that can change that according to Rav Meir. However, if stipulation is made prior to when they got married, that I'm not going to, that property will be exclusively yours and I do not own that property or get any rights to that property, he may do so. Now in that very limited scenario, now that's the first brisa that we quote on this summit. That's the first Mishnah, which is, then the wife can accept the shituf because she's a chatzar owner, it's going to help her, and migu, since it helps her, so therefore she can acquire it on behalf of other people. That's the only circumstance where she could be the recipient of the shituf on behalf of others.
So barzel is the one or not? Or it has to be a separate one?
No, this is, in other words, it's neither. It's neither nichsim malugit som barzel. It's neither som barzel. It's a special case where he waives. Okay, and just finishing up, I mean, we finished the Gemara, but just finishing up, so on this very pretty basic issue of who do we follow, like, do we follow like Rav or do we follow like Shmuel? Rav holds like Reb Meir, that whatever the wife acquires immediately goes to the husband, and you can't even make a stipulation otherwise. That is, she just Rav holding like Reb Meir, and Shmuel disagrees, and Shmuel says, no, the halacha follows like... the halacha does not follow like Reb Meir, but rather like the Chachamim, that a person can give a wife even money with the stipulation that your husband does not receive a portion in it, and that stipulation would in fact work. So who does the halacha follow like? So that's why the Ran is very lengthy on this page, because it is a major debate amongst the Rishonim. On one hand, the Ran points out that this is a fundamentally a mamonos issue, because even though we're learning Masechta Nedarim now, and Nedarim is not money. Nedarim is this of a heter, but really at the root of this whole discussion is how to understand the rabbinic legislation of how money works within a marriage. That's a monetary issue. And we know whenever we have a monetary debate between Rav and Shmuel, the halacha falls like Shmuel and not like Rav. So even though the application of the halacha applies to Nedarim, but really fundamentally it's rooted in money, and so therefore many Rishonim say, the Ran quotes them, many Rishonim say that the halacha falls like Shmuel, not like Rav. There are a couple of other Rishonim, Rabbeinu Tam and the Ravid. The Ran quotes it. It's not my bekias. Rabbeinu Tam and the Ravid, who disagree and say no, that the halacha falls like Rav. The Rambam is somewhere in the middle of all this, and the Ran tries to make sense of the Rambam, who's on one hand does pass like Shmuel, on the other hand, and when discussing the Darim, says that the father, if he wants to give money to his daughter, has to go through the very specific formulation as presented in our Mishnah, and according to Shmuel, that's unnecessary. Why does the Rambam do that? The Ran goes on to discuss. Anyway, that's the. But let's just quickly summarize what we saw. That far I didn't go. I just, you know, I went through the run, but I didn't go further. So let's just quickly review. The issue that we start off our discussion is a husband has a lack of knowledge. If he doesn't know about hafara, that's considered like he knows nothing. And therefore, once he learns about the concept of hafara, so then he has now he's on the clock. What if he knows about the concept of hafara, but he didn't know that, and he knew about nedar, but he didn't know that this is a kind of neder that can be mefer? So that was a machlokes between Rav Meir and the Chachamim in our Mishnah. Rav Meir says he can't be mefer, and according to the first explanation of the Ran, not even today he can be mefer, because it's not enough information. In other words, he doesn't have enough knowledge to create that afar. The Chachamim disagree. The Gemara thinks that this is a larger issue of whether partial knowledge is considered knowledge or not knowledge. That's why the Gemara spent time comparing this to the case of Gullus and whether or not the blind person is sent into Gullus. But the Gemara says there are two separate issues. The second big discussion we had today is where the father-in-law made an eder against the son-in-law and wants to give money to his daughter. So how does he do so? So the Mishnah gave a very specific formula in terms of what the father needs to say in order so that he can A, give his money daughter, but B, not be in violation of his neder. And then the question that we discussed for the rest of today was, does the halacha in fact follow our Mishnah? Rav says it does, Shmuel says it doesn't. And in terms of the Rishonim themselves are split on this issue of who do we follow like Rav or Shmuel.